Andrew Johnson from the Center for Hebraic Thought. It was our pleasure to host Rabbi Dr. Jeremiah Unterman at the King's College for a public lecture that he gave on the topic of moral progress. And specifically, does the Hebrew Bible depict something like moral progress, and how does that compare to other ethical perspectives in the ancient Near East? Jerry has joined the team as an academic fellow for the Center for Hebraic Thought, and so we're very glad to have him on board. This is a public lecture where he'll be introduced by our own administrator, Abigail Smith, and then his lecture will last about 30 minutes and we'll end it before the Q&A. I hope you enjoy.
The Institute of Biblical Research, a Christian society for biblical scholars, dedicated an entire session of their 2018 meeting to a close examination of his book, Justice for All, which is the subject of the talk today, by no less than 7 biblical scholars, which is a lot of attention and a big deal. And finally, the Canadian Jewish News said of Dr. Unterman, "With scholarly training in the Bible and the ancient Near East, he's one of the small number of people who could undertake this project to challenge the scholarly perception that the Jewish Bible has made at best an only inconsequential contribution to the ethical development of ancient Near Eastern values." Please extend a warm welcome to Dr. Jeremiah Unterman.
Thank you very much, Abby. Ladies and gentlemen, I owe a debt of gratitude to my dear friend, Professor Drew Johnson, for inviting me here today. It's indeed a great honor for me to have been given this opportunity to speak to you under the aegis of the Center for Hebraic Thought. Since I'm obviously Jewish, I'll start off with a Jewish joke, and actually a Jewish-Israeli joke. But first, I'll give you a little background. In Jerusalem, the main transportation method is by the Egged buses. And the Egged bus drivers are flat-out crazy. They take turns, you know, on two wheels. We don't worry about terrorism in Israel. We worry about being in the Egged bus. A rabbi passed away, and his soul went up to heaven and gets up to the angel at the pearly gates. And the angel says to him, Rabbi Rabinowitz, we've been expecting you. Please go to the end of the line. We'll be with you in a few minutes. All right. Well, nonplussed, goes to the end of the line. And standing there. And all of a sudden, another soul comes up, and immediately the heavenly gates open, the trumpets are blaring, the heavenly choir is singing, there's fireworks, right? And people are cheering, and soul goes right in. Gates close. Rabbi, what's going on? He goes back to the angel and says, "Excuse me," he says. "Who was that?" "Ah, Rabbi, that was an Egged bus driver." Rabbi says, "An Egged bus driver?" He says, "I was a rabbi for 40 years. I gave sermons every Sabbath. I don't understand. How come you put me at the end of the line?" And he goes right in. Angel says, "Truly, Rabbi, you don't understand. When you gave sermons, people slept. When he drove, people prayed." So I hope I won't put you to sleep, but neither do I hope to make you so scared that you will end up praying out of fear. Okay. Moral progress, does the Hebrew Bible give the world moral progress or just another system of morality? So I know you're all sitting on pins and needles waiting to hear my answer, so let me relieve you of the tension and answer the question. Yes, the Hebrew Bible gave the world moral progress. All right, Drew, can I leave now? Okay. All right. Okay. So, and as you heard from Abby, What I will tell you today is based upon my recent book, Justice for All, How the Jewish Bible Revolutionized Ethics. You probably don't know the term Jewish Bible, but basically because you have a Bible. You call the Bible the Christian Bible, if you think about it. The way the Christians call the Bible. Jews call their Bible the Bible also. But when Christians refer to it, they refer to both the Old and New Testaments. And when Jews refer to it, they just refer to what you call the Old Testament, what we call just the Bible or scriptures or Tanakh, which is what this word is over here. Okay, in Hebrew, it stands for, it's an acronym, Torah, meaning the five books of Moses. The N sound is for Nevi'im, meaning prophets. And the N, the Chaf sound, the German guttural, is for what's called Ketuvim, the writings, the Psalms, Proverbs, etc. Okay. And that's the order, by the way, in which the books appear in the Hebrew Bible, which I know is different than what appears in the Christian Old Testament, which is okay. I don't mind. Okay. Now, okay. So I've been thinking about the importance of the ethics of the Jewish Bible, for at least 40 years or more before I wrote the book. Frankly, I think too much scholarship has focused on when a book of the Hebrew Bible was written or its different authors or the composite nature of the book, how it was put together. I always thought that the most important subject should be, what does the Bible have to say? What does it mean, particularly in terms of God and ethics? If it doesn't teach ethical standards that are essential for making society and the world a better place, then what does that say about the Bible or God? And if it does teach these standards, then are they just copies of something that already existed in other cultures? Or are they something unique that needs to be publicized? The more I studied, and I have to tell you, I mean, yeah, I'm a religious Jew, but my knowledge comes from academia. Okay. The more I studied, the more I realized that the Hebrew Bible's ethics were something totally new in the ancient world. Further, even though some of these ethics have influenced Christianity and Islam, and from them to much of the world, much still needs to be restated, thought about, and applied. I hope that I can convey to you some of these essential elements of the ethics of the Hebrew Bible today. This is not to say that there are no moral standards or ethical sense in the ancient Near East, or even that the Bible itself doesn't have some ethically, shall we say, uncomfortable text. What is the issue is the Bible's revolutionary understanding of both God and ethics. And that's what I'll try and focus on. Once upon a time, there was an extremely important part of the ancient Near East, of the world, which was called the cradle of civilization, which is what we term the ancient Near East. And you see here, this world existed basically from, in terms of the names you see here, from about 3000 BCE to, about 300 or so to the Greek conquest. And you see that on the lower right, that blue area is the Persian Gulf. And you go up through the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. The Tigris is the one on the right, and the Euphrates on the left. And then you come on down through the coast of the Mediterranean on the eastern side there, and down all the way to Egypt. And what you have is you have the ancient cultures of Sumer and the Babylonian Empire and the Assyrian Empire, the ones in, and then you have above the Hittite Empire, which is in lower Turkey and Anatolia, and down through all the way to the Egyptian Empire, and the various small countries and the kingdoms in between. Now, we have, anybody want to guess? How many ancient inscriptions, whether they be on stone or they be in tablets or even on papyrus, how many, or on parchment, how many inscriptions do you think we have today that have been uncovered from the ancient Near East? From before, let's say, I'll go even before the Dead Sea Scrolls, okay? So from to around 300 BC. Anybody want to guess? It's okay. All right. We have about a million. A million. That's a lot. Now, not all these million have been read. Because after all, how many people do you think read Akkadian? Right? Ancient Babylonian, right? If you want to make money in academia, learn to read Akkadian. There'll be a job for you somewhere. Okay? There's like hundreds of thousands of Talmuds that have not yet been read. There aren't enough people to read them. Okay? So, however, a lot has been read. So what I'm going to tell you is on the basis of what has been read and translated by good scholarship, etc. So I want to talk about a few things, about a few statements about ancient Near Eastern gods and ethics. The gods of the ancient Near East are natural beings. In that sense, they are no different than humans. They are from nature, part of nature. They eat, they drink, they sleep, they have sex, they make war, they are born, and even sometimes die or can be killed. They are part and parcel of nature. Just give you a quick example from Enuma Elish. Enuma Elish is one of the main texts from Babylonia. It is the creation epic, the primary creation epic in ancient Babylonia. So this is from the beginning. When the heavens above did not exist and the earth beneath had not come into being, there was, meaning before heaven and earth existed, there was Apshu, the first in order, their begetter, and Demiurge, Tiamat, she's the female, who gave birth to them all. They had mingled their waters together. Okay? They had mingled their waters together, meaning that these are watery beings, or beings that have water as part of them, right? So they are part of nature, even though, shall we say, nature was in compared to after this creation occurs, nature was somewhat in a chaotic state, but it was nature. Okay. Now, so while possessed of superhuman powers, the gods are not omnipotent. As natural beings, they are affected by nature. So, let's take a look. This is Tablet 11 of the Gilgamesh Epic, also known as the one of the primary Babylonian stories of the Flood. And this is when the flood actually occurs, the outpouring of the rains from the heavens brought on by one of the gods in consultation with some of the other gods. Oh, were stricken with terror the gods at the deluge. Fleeing, they rose to the heaven of Anu and crouched in the outskirts, cowering like curs were the gods, while like to a woman in travail, the goddess Ishtar did cry. Okay? Right? So the outpouring of nature is so huge, intense, that the gods are in terror of it. Okay. And it's not just natural, these kinds of natural forces that limit or scare the gods. The gods are subject to and cannot control completely also time, magic. There is magic in the ancient world. Destiny. They are not in control of destiny. And divination. Divination is when humans try to ascertain what the gods' plans are that will affect themselves. And so, in other words, the humans, by divining, are trying to put, shall we say, a phone tap on the gods' phones, right? So they can find out what the gods don't really necessarily want them to find out. And why do they want this? So that they can circumvent them. Now, if the gods have a plan that's going to affect the humans negatively, they want to find, the humans want to find out about it so they can do something to circumvent it. All right. Now, let's talk about ethics a little bit. Ethically, the gods are capricious. Sometimes they do behave justly, and sometimes they don't. And let's look again at the Gilgamesh epic. This is actually in the same tablet, 11, after the flood. And after the flood, what happens is that Udnapishtim, the Babylonian Noah, or in a different story, he's called Atrahasis, okay, he sacrifices after the boat lands, not on Ararat, but on a different mountain. And unto the four winds of heaven I feed. These, by the way, he's the Babylonian Udnapishtim is telling the story of what happened to Gilgamesh. I don't know if you know, Gilgamesh is this great hero who was searching for immortality. So Udnapishtim and his wife were humans who became immortalized by the gods after the flood. They're the ones who were saved, right? Unto the four wings of heaven I feed all the beasts and an offering sacrifice. The gods smell the sweet, the savor. I, the gods, did assemble like flies over him making the offering. Why were the gods hovering over the offerer like flies? Because during the time of the flood, the poor goddess hadn't eaten. Because the humans, right, were the ones who gave them sacrifices, right? The food and nectar of the gods. The sacrifice, the purpose of the sacrifices was to feed the gods. Right? Then Enlil, he was a great god, on his arrival, spied out the vessel and that burst into anger against the gods. Whereat Ea was the patron of Udnapishtim, and he's the one who told Udnapishtim that there would be a flood, obliquely, so he couldn't be accused of telling him directly. Okay? Spoke unto Enlil, the warrior, saying, O chieftain, thou of the gods, thou warrior, thou, how forsooth, how all uncounseled, could you bring this deluge on? Visit the sin, his sin on the sinner. Visit his guilt on the guilty. But oh, have mercy, they should not be cut off. In other words, you didn't judge righteously. You didn't do it correctly. You should have been more circumspect in how you behaved. Okay. The attitudes of the gods to humans are notably problematic. On the one hand, Mesopotamian kings state that the gods told them to ensure justice in society. On the other, the Babylonian creation epic and other texts affirm that humans were created to be slaves to the gods and to enable them to rest by doing all the work for them, including building them palaces, what we call temples, okay, as befits their divine royalty. In contrast to the ancient and Eastern deities, the God of the Hebrew Bible is supernatural, pre-existing nature and having no physical needs. God is metaphysical. He does not eat or drink and therefore has no corporeal need for sacrifices. As Psalm 50 states, for example, were I hungry, I would not tell you, for mine is the world and all it holds. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of he goats? I mean, I'm just taking two verses out of a whole bunch here. Okay, you can read the psalm for yourself some other time. No other deity in the ancient Near East could ever have made that claim. God is not only supernatural, but omnipotent. He creates and affects nature. Nature does not affect God. And lastly, God is just and God is good and God creates a good world. The biblical creation story produces three major ethical innovations. I could probably come up with more, but just for the sake of this talk. Humans are created to be good rulers. Both men and women are made in the image of God, and the Sabbath is the birth of equality. These are the three things I want to talk about. So, humans are blessed by God to be good rulers, not slaves. And God said, let us make the human in our image and our likeness, and they shall rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and over the cattle and over all the earth and all the teeming things that teem upon the earth. All right, so we're created to be rulers, but I would contend good rulers, because God is good. And if God is making humans in his image, then as a ruler, it seems that the text is saying on the very basic level, then it should be a good ruler. Look at, and I'm going to throw in verse 29. God said, behold, I've given you every seed-bearing plant that's upon the earth and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit for food. So according to this text, what are we supposed to eat? You know?
Avocados.
Avocados, yeah, right? What else? Avocados, I love avocados. What else? Let's just look at the text. Let's look at that one verse. I've given you every seed-bearing plant and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit for food. So what cannot the humans eat? Huh? Each other. What else can they not eat? That's true. Absolutely true. What else can they not eat? Animals. They're not given permission here to eat animals. How does this make sense? Let's see here. How about this? A good ruler does not eat his subjects. All right? Okay. The purpose of God's nonviolent creation is to lead to a world without bloodshed. Okay? Now, note the last verse on that page. The image of God refers to all men and women equally. It is true that due to the basic ancient understanding of the patriarchal nature of human society in the Hebrew Bible, the biblical text does not depict a society in which men and women have equal rights in the legal and socioeconomic systems. At the same time, the equality of the genders appears in verse 27. And God created the human in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And by the way, you notice that I'm capitalizing the he in reference to God. I don't think I need to tell you God is not a he and God is not a she. All right, this is simply a factor of biblical Hebrew, which only speaks in genders. Okay, you find this sometimes in English also. A ship in English is a she. Okay? Doesn't make a difference that a ship is not a she, right? Not sexually a she, not biologically a she, right? Okay. All right, that's, and by the way, in Hebrew also, a ship is a she. Okay. Say that many times. Okay. All right, now. Okay. So, God, okay. So you have also the quality of male and female appears in dialogues between the patriarchs and matriarchs in the Genesis narratives, in the obligation of children to treat their parents equally in the Ten Commandments, honor your father and mother, right? And you also have a statement in Leviticus, Each person shall revere his mother and his father. Their mother comes first, right? As well as in the view of Proverbs, the book of Proverbs, that both parents are seen as equal teachers of the child. All these indicate that the Hebrew Bible did not justify the reality of social imbalance as due to men being innately superior to women. There are no negative stereotypes that are ever attached to women as a whole in the Hebrew Bible. The fact that individual women such as Miriam, Deborah, Huldah the prophetess could be characterized and accepted as prophetesses, and Deborah, of course, is a judge, which means she's the leader of the people, is further evidence that women were not perceived in the Bible as inferior to men. So even if the Jewish Bible itself did not advocate a socioeconomic revolution in women's rights, it created the foundation for such a revolution in the future. In similar fashion, Jefferson's All Men Are Created Equal and the Declaration of Independence will be eventually understood to encompass all humans, right? And not just what went by for the citizens of that period. Okay. And I thought about the Sabbath. The divinely established beginning of human rights is in the Sabbath. The Sabbath rest as the first law of equality in society. Look at Genesis 2, verse 3. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all the work of creation that he had done. And this is followed up in the Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath day to make it holy. You shall work for 6 days and do all your labor, and the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God, right? It's in what's called imitatio Dei, imitating God, right? You shall not do any labor. You and your son or your daughter, your male servant or slave, there's the same word for servant and slave, there's one Hebrew word, or your maid slave or your servant, and the alien who's within your gates, the person, the stranger, the resident alien who is not part of your ethnic society, not part of the dominant social body, okay, but who and is not the one who received the, as we will talk about it, the Torah, the instructions of God on Mount Sinai, okay, for. But he has to rest, or she has to rest also on the Sabbath. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh Sabbath day and made it holy. And you see, obviously, it goes back to the creation story. No other ancient society conceived of a weekly day of rest from all work. In fact, there was no week elsewhere in the ancient world, because as opposed to the day, sunrise to sunrise or sunset to sunset, okay, or as opposed to the month, which comes from the word moon, right, which is takes the 29 and a half days, or approximately that takes for a little more than a quarter, 29 and a quarter plus, it takes for the moon to go for around the earth. Right, and as opposed to the year, right, defined by the seasons, the week is a totally artificial time period. Right? So nobody else had a week. The Bible invented the week and the weekend. The concept of the Sabbath rest had a democratizing influence upon society. All were equal for one full day a week, and also on certain holidays they're not allowed to work. Right? You understand? A society in which a slave could not work? I'll take questions afterwards, okay? Unless there's something you didn't understand that I said.
It's just highly relevant to what you're saying now. In Genesis, don't the animals get the day of rest too?
Ah, yes. Yes, right, yes. You also have that, yes. In Deuteronomy, it's also talked about, right? So about animals resting, In fact, I'm going to make that point. So even King David could not ask his lowly slave to saddle his horse on that day. In fact, even he couldn't saddle his horse because his horse couldn't work on the Sabbath. The effect of such a desideratum on society cannot be minimized. Here the Bible establishes a weekly rest period as the first universal labor law, human rights for all members of society, along with a limitation of government. Okay. I'm going to have to move quickly. All right. I want to get to a particular thing, so I'm going to have to... I see I only have like 15 minutes. Okay. So I want to make a few comments about the biblical flood story. In the Babylonian story, the flood happens actually for the same reason, it happens in the creation story. Why the gods fight each other? But I'll talk about the Babylonian flood story because we have this in one of the versions of the flood story, in which only that version explains what's going on. The humans are making too much noise while the gods are trying to rest. So the gods decide to kill off all the humans. Okay. So, the Utnapishtim, the one we all talked about who was saved, Utnapishtim is saved only because he's a favorite of one of the gods. Contrast that with Noah, who is saved with his family because he's righteous and because the rest of the world is acting with extreme violence. And so only Noah and his family are saved. The principle here is that God rules the world with justice. Now you also have a very important statement in the Israel flood story, which is repeated in Genesis 6:5, and God saw that human evil was great upon the earth, and that every formation of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all day long. And then it's repeated at the end of after the flood has subsided, about humans, that for the formation of the heart of man is evil from his youth. Now, if the Bible wanted to say people are evil, it could have said it. Now, what is this complex kind of formulation? The idea here, and again, I'm going to have to encapsulate. You can look in my book if you want to for the details, okay? The idea here is that humans are innately selfish. We have to recognize this about ourselves. We basically look out for number one. I know you haven't heard that before, but okay. And then maybe we'll do something else along the line. But the whole idea of looking out for yourself is a very natural type of concept. How does the Bible deal with this? If humans are innately selfish, then how can they be expected to also do good? Because the Bible makes another assumption, which you have in many, many texts. It's actually assumed every time there's a commandment. Why does God make commandments if people are basically selfish? Because there's an assumption that people have free will. And people know the difference between good and evil. And therefore, they can use their free will to counteract their selfish impulses and to do what is good. Okay. That's the second message that comes out of here. And the third message is a message of hope, because the flood story ends with the rainbow, as it were, right? And with the rainbow as symbolizing that God will never again destroy the earth by flood. And you can think about it. God will no longer war against the earth. If you think about the rainbow in Hebrew, is simply called a bow. It doesn't refer to the kind of bow you put in your hair, okay? It's like a bow, think of a bow and arrow, right? Notice how the rainbow is positioned in the sky. All right? The bow is at rest. It says for you were to hang it on a wall, as it were. All right? In other words, it's no longer pointed, as God is not shooting arrows, as it were, at the earth anymore. Right? So the idea that the symbol of God's in the sky every time, as it were, it rains, is a promise to humanity that humanity will not be destroyed by God. Maybe humanity will destroy itself. And that, therefore, that it gives hope for the future. People cannot live without hope. Okay. I want to move quickly to say a few words about the Sinai experience. I'm sorry again that I prepared too much material. Okay. In the Sinai experience in Exodus, where you have something going on which does not appear anywhere else in the ancient world. You have several things going on. First of all, God reveals himself to the entire people. I don't mean physically. I mean in the sense of that God shows, because God is not physical. Okay, but God reveals, he speaks to the entire people. No other people in recorded history ever made that statement. We have no examples in recorded history of that statement from any other society. Gods usually only reveal themselves to one person at a time. Okay. And never, I say, to even a large group, okay, much less an entire people. Secondly, God makes a covenant with his people. Covenant's a terrible term. It's this ancient old English law term. It translates the Hebrew word for brit, meaning the Hebrew word brit, okay, which actually means treaty. God makes a treaty with the people. Again, nowhere else do you have this idea of God, of a God ever making a treaty with the people, and certainly no such treaty is ever recorded. And thirdly, God gives the people of Israel his laws, his commandments. Again, you have no example elsewhere in the ancient world of a God ever giving a people his laws, and there's no place that people can point to and saying, oh, these are the laws given to me by God X. Okay? It doesn't happen. What does this mean? A couple of things. Treaties were the kind of treaty that God makes with Israel. We know the style. The style is an ancient Near Eastern style known as the Hittite Suzerain Vassal Treaty. It's a treaty made between the great emperor of the Hittites with a lesser king. And in that treaty, the emperor makes the treaty. The lesser king has to obey. The lesser king has to give loyalty to the great emperor. And there are the stipulations of the treaty, which refer to the loyalty that that lesser king must give to the emperor. Now, when God makes a treaty with the Israelites, he doesn't make it with the king of the Israelites. He doesn't make it with the leader, Moses. He makes it with every single adult Israelite. So as it were, every single adult Israelite is raised to the level of a vassal king. And each Israelite is responsible for keeping this treaty. And the treaty has, the stipulations of the treaty are the laws given to the people. So if God is trying to create, he is a just society, every single person is responsible for that just society. And therefore, since God gives it, therefore the people will be rewarded if they obey, and they will be punished if they won't. So in other words, the laws of the society, it's not just, if I break an American law, right? I'm not worried about all Americans being punished or rewarded, right? If I don't break it, I just know I'm going to be liable. But in the Israelite society, and everybody was liable to everybody else, because if you have mutual responsibility between the society and the individual, because if you do what's wrong, you can help bring tragedy to the society. And if you do what's right, you can help bring great reward to the society. So therefore, law has a conceptual value far beyond that of any other society. Furthermore, because the humans are made in the image of God, therefore, human life becomes holy, becomes sacred. Every human life, which is why when you get to, you have laws about 50 different passages in the Torah refer to laws on behalf of the stranger, the resident alien, right? The person who is not like you, the person who does not resemble you, the person who is different from you, okay? That person is as important to you as anybody else. And it says in Leviticus, right, you shall love, right, your neighbor, right? Right? You know, you shall show love for your neighbor, like yourself. I know that that's also important in the New Testament. And it also says in that same chapter in Leviticus 19, it says, and you shall show love for the stranger as yourself. Nobody else has that. Nobody else has anything close to it. Right? Okay. So the whole concept of human value undergoes a tremendous transformation. I will just close here with maybe a couple of paragraphs. Because I haven't even mentioned the prophets yet. So I'll give you one message from the prophets concerning the idea of redemption. The prophets build upon what is already in the Torah in terms of the idea of redemption, of redeeming the entire people from exile, from destruction. And the prophetic articulation of this idea built upon the Torah is built upon the Torah's image of God as the mother of creation, so I haven't explained to you, as the father of humankind, and the people of Israel as the firstborn of God. These are images, metaphors, okay? The prophets a promise that God will redeem the ancient Jews from exile, bring them back to him, because he is both the father, the ultimate father, and the ultimate mother, and bring them back to the land of Israel to live in peace and security. So too, the rest of the world would enjoy peace and security when they recognize the value of the Torah. In accordance, for example, with the immortal words of the prophet Isaiah. I don't have to tell you the effect upon the early Christians of these prophecies of hope and trust in the future. The formidable empires of the ancient Near East are all dead, and their values are buried by the sands of time. Only the unparalleled, divinely given ethics of one small, insignificant people encapsulated in the Hebrew Bible, have survived. May those ethics yet enlighten our own darkened world today, and may their practice lead the way to the ultimate divine redemption, which I am sure will greatly exceed both Christian and Jewish expectations. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.